Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Last week we presented Professor's sixth talk in this new series, and today we'll be having a question and answer session. As always, the questions will be posed by a panel, and the panelists today are Radio Sai's Bishop Rushdie and Professor Peter Prusen from Denmark. And Professor G. Venkatraman, as always, will be answering and clarifying the questions put up by the panel. So, over to Professor Venkatraman for his opening remarks and then taking it further.
You want me to give an answer without a question?
No, so for your opening remarks.
Opening remarks is who is going to fire first. I think Professor Prusen is a new guest here, yes. First appearance. Yes. So, we welcome him.
Yes.
And I make a special request, please don't ask difficult questions, at least to start with. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to participate. It's a joy for a number of reasons, particularly because the subject matter that we're discussing is something that has been very near to my heart for many, many years. I found it to be a privilege to be in the company of you, sir, and the author of the book whose words we are discussing. In the late 1980s, I was dealing with a number of issues that were very similar to those raised by Mr. Das. I had been leading a project dealing with practical applications of ethics in the world of business and developed a concept called ethical accounting, where instead of measuring the value or the progress of a corporation by how much money it earned, the whole idea was to say, to what extent has the company lived up to the values of those people it affects?
So can you quantify this?
Pardon me?
Can you quantify that?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
That would be another discussion.
Yes.
This led, in fact, indirectly to a whole development throughout the world in other forms for accounting, where people have tried to measure the social responsibility of a corporation or its environmental track record.
Oh, wow.
It was a deviation from traditional financial accounting.
Yes, yeah.
And that actually led to my coming to Swami. That's another story. But to relate this to Chapter 2 and to Professor Venkatraman's
Chapter comments, 2 of Das's book.
Das's book, yes.
Draupadi's courage.
In Chapter 2, Draupadi demands, but she does not receive an answer to the question, what is left of the Dharma of kings? Her reaction is spontaneous. She's suffering a deep humiliation, and she reacts spontaneously. It is not a reaction based upon a discussion with others or reference to or deep thinking or reference to learned people. She reacts strongly and spontaneously. Well, in contrast to such a personally threatening situation, the king in a modern-day setting, let me refer to the king here as the chief executive officer of a large multinational corporation, he or she may have to respond to take initiatives regarding decisions that not only affect himself, but many, many others. For example, what the management literature refers to as stakeholders, customers, employees, owners, local societies, nature, and so on. So the question that I'm dealing with is, does what Das write have any relevance for how such a modern king, a CEO, can know what is the right thing to do? At one point in the chapter, he writes, given the plurality of authorities, and here he appears to refer to scriptures, rules and regulations. He says, one has to depend on oneself. In other words, he appears to say that there is no frame of reference that this modern king can apply to determine what is the right thing to do, or that we others can use to judge his activities. If we follow Das, the leader must simply find out for himself what is the right thing to do, perhaps assisted by expensive consultants. In my opinion, this is a recipe for disaster. In a world where leaders' decisions can affect the well-being of individuals and societies all over the world. And this is in direct opposition to the framework that I myself developed in the late 1980s, where Ideally speaking, a decision is ethical if all those who are affected by it give their approval. So it should be clear that if we follow Das's reasoning, such a leader cannot be said to have responsibility to other than those he chooses to be evaluated by. In the case of business, those people who own the corporation, and the only measure of success is how much money they are earning. I think I had more to say, but I think I will stop at this point and ask you, sir, for your comments on these reflections.
You have raised, Professor, a lot of issues. Maybe you should try to read the first chapter of the book, where Das quotes an experience of his when he was in the corporate sector, but not at the top position. The company was facing a sudden difficulty. Basically, the company was having a dealing with government, which led to a lot of corruption. And the CEO no longer wanted to have that contract. He said, let's keep the government contract and go for something else. But it meant sacking a lot of people. It was very uncomfortable. And everybody told him, don't do this and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, he just had to do it and built up the company by going to other people who bought their products and brought back the profits. So that is what you call an answer to this question in an earlier chapter. The other issue, what do you do when you are faced with tough questions in a realistic situation? The answer to that has been devised and given in earlier times. And the answer is in one word, pragmatism. Be pragmatic and do what you can. And in the world of politics, I think, I don't remember who it was, somebody used the word real politic. Probably
Kissinger.
Kissinger borrowed it. It was Bismarck, I think.
Bismarck.
But Kissinger used it.
It was Bismarck, yes.
Now, in all those things, you try to be 60% correct, 70% correct, and really speaking, in these things, you cannot measure. There is too much of measurement in the Western world, as David Bohm says. The word matra become meter and measurement, whereas in Vedanta it goes into Maya. There are certain things which are better not quantified. When I say something and I hurt you, how can I measure how much I hurt you? And as Swami said, her words hurt more than wounds caused by knife. There I can measure it. So much blood loss, this is the organ injury and all that, the hurt of the mind. So we cannot quantify certain things, and we are talking here about the mind and so forth. We have to try and see whether we are compromising some basic principle. That is the guidance of Swami. Don't look at damage, etc., at the detail level. If you are defending a basic principle, I will write off the collateral damage. That is the advice Krishna gives to Arjuna at the end. This is Arjuna, I have decided they shall die. If you don't do it, someone else will do it.
Yes.
But I want you to do it, taking my name and believing in Dharma as I represent Dharma. So, my own suggestion would be to first meditate intensely on God and ask Him to show the right decision, and then go ahead with it in the full belief that what I am doing is right and as ordained by God. And when that is done, it turns out that the damage is also minimized. And there is a very real example for this.
in the life of late Mr. Gopal Rao, who used to be the CEO of the Andhra Bank, and he faced a lockout. And there was a lot of political pressure on him. And late Mr. Gopal Rao, I must mention, was only too ready to tell the story about the Andhra Bank. Almost on all occasions, at the drop of a hat, he would come out with the full story. We enjoyed that, of course.
And he did it in physical presence of Swami.
Yes, many times. So, but he stuck to his principles. Swami said, just don't compromise. And ultimately it worked out.
Sure.
So it was a practical case of literally following. He was, you know, reviled and abused, and a lot of political pressure was put on him. He said, no, I'm not doing this. But things worked out. So, if one really has faith in God, I would prefer that option. Otherwise, one has to see what is right under certain circumstances. And unfortunately, even if I feel right, let us say I'm the leader of a country, the political establishment will not allow me. The mandarins in the various departments will stifle me. But there are occasions when this could be done. I give you a very interesting example. It's Freeman Dyson writes about top-level nuclear negotiations. This was before the Gorbachev-Reagan, this thing. This was the time of Khrushchev or somewhere thereabouts. Avril Harriman landed in Moscow. And he said, I'm leaving in 3 days. I want an agreement in 3 days. That's it. So that sent a message to the other side. So they kept in chains all their bureaucrats. And Avril Harriman paid scant respect to bureaucrats inside, from the defense and the nuclear scientists, all of whom are vested interests. He simply said, I'm going back with an agreement in 3 days. And Dyson said, everybody got it done in 3 days. And in that context, I'll stop here. He makes a very interesting remark. He says, with reference to Karma Yoga of the Bhagavad Gita, it is very easy to teach Indians to think like Americans, but very difficult to teach Americans to think like Indians. In other words, he said, do the job in the spirit of Karma Yoga. I was astonished that this man, who he has been in very difficult these things, how to cut through all this maze. So, you know, even in nuclear negotiations, the Bhagavad Gita is useful. I don't know whether I clarified, but I made an earnest effort too.
Thank you very much. Perhaps I could continue just very briefly.
Go ahead.
I think in the world, the modern world of business at least, there's such an emphasis upon avoiding being challenged for being unethical. When people talk about ethics, also at business schools, they really don't talk about ethics. They talk about unethics. They talk about all the things you should not do or don't be caught for doing. There's no emphasis really upon doing the right thing. Could you comment on that?
I think they have placed the objective of the corporation's profits first, rather than seeing the corporation as an organ of society, which is supposed to do its job. I mean, leaving aside what is happening today, if you went back 50 years, the university had a social purpose, a purpose which involved making contribution to human society. The medical, the hospitals had a similar idea, thou shalt heal. But when hospitals assume the role of profit-earning organizations, and when education is for money, and even so-called non-profit hospitals in universities, like they have in America, make more profit than corporations, then something is horrible in the state of Denmark. I apologize, but I blame Shakespeare for it. So, we don't ask that question because it's an inconvenient truth we would have to face.
Yes.
So, by and large, all these ethics programs in various schools is how to sweep the inconvenient truth under the rug.
Yeah.
That's my feeling. I don't think they are really honest.
No.
If they were honest, they would talk like Swami.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, they put the, they've turned things on their head for some way. Corporations certainly need money to live.
Yeah,
but in order to,
not
but
live, to live, I think live a luxurious life.
But to live in order to have money is ridiculous. We need, like air, we have to breathe air to live. It would be a very poor life if we simply lived to breathe air. Just following up on your ideas of this focus on money, I totally agree with that.
This is because of the growth of hyper-individualism and corporationist people, according to the
yes.
recent ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court. Hyper-individualism and a total disconnect of the so-called individualist society. And I'm shocked and stunned to hear Margaret Thatcher say there is no such thing as society.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean? We are asking for trouble. And we, one of the ways in which society is concretized is via government. We don't want an oppressive government. But that does not mean government should be treated as a permanent enemy. As Clinton said, government is an enemy till you need a friend.
Yes.
When there is a disaster, you go to the government. What is the government doing? It's nothing. Where is the government? Blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
And the government must be a collective soul of the individual.
Yes.
At least in the scriptures of India, again and again Swami said, society is God. It is macro God, you are micro God. If you don't have any symbiotic relationship with each other, if you renounce society, society will renounce you.
If I could go back just spontaneously thinking about the situation described in Chapter 2 of Das's book, we have that situation, we have an individual, Draupadi, and we look at the world, what's going on through her eyes. If we look at a major corporation today, the people at the top have no knowledge about what really is going on in the world. The companies are so big, so spread out over so many worlds, using so many different technologies that no single person is able really to see what is good or bad, what is right or wrong. And therefore they fall prey to the economists' guidance, which says reduce everything to money, look at that, and then you don't have to worry about all of the real things that are going on. Do you share that view? Is that
Yes, I share that view, but I'd like to make two argument points leading up from what you have just said. Let me go back to Draupadi. I said society is indifferent to the individuals. Today's society is indifferent because it's cut off. Society, by that you mean government, they live in their big buildings where they are pushing files, working the phones and so on and so forth. Draupadi was facing a moral crisis in front of an assembly. They were all witnesses to that. There were educated people there. There were men of wisdom there. There were men of experience there. They saw what was going on. And they kept their mouth shut.
Yes.
This is an early warning from the Mahabharata. Even if they are looking, they will remain silent. Is that acceptable? That is point number one.
Yes.
With regard to the alarming growth of technology, just yesterday I heard on the BBC that about 15 to 20 people have signed a manifesto opposing excessive introduction of AI. One of them is Lord Martin Rees. He's an astronomer royal, very distinguished astronomer, but a man with a social conscience, deep social conscience. And he was the man who discovered the quasars. That's why he's famous. And he gave the BBC Reith Memorial Lectures a few years ago. And another is Stephen Hawking. He says, programming skills are increasing enormously. The man could write codes that make the robots more and more powerful. They could teach the robots to write codes.
Yes.
And it may so happen that without their knowledge, they have taught the robot so much, it will write a code that will be destructive to man. By that time, it may be too late. I mean, I was surprised that scientists who are so techno-friendly, technophiles, were giving this warning. BBC played the synthetic voice of Stephen Hawking with the computer synthesizer giving this warning. It also quoted Lord Martin Rees. It has come to that stage where those who are driving development are themselves screaming, slam the brakes. So luckily, we have even today men who have some conscience in them and sense of alarm. But where these are people who are not connected with money, by the way.
No, that's a big difference.
So we have to have a rally of people who don't value money, but value society and nature. And there are a lot of us. Our problem is we don't come together. There is no pencil connecting the dots.
And that is why I think that Das's book is so exceptional. As you pointed out in earlier discussions, he's taking a strongly secular perspective. But given that he's done that, I think his work is quite amazing, thought-provoking. He appears to be challenging his own standpoint in many positions where in the very introduction, he speaks of seeking for a secular perspective on what is right or wrong. He finds himself, I think, compelled by his own arguments to move very much towards a view that transcends matter and the mind as the only arbitrators as to what is right and wrong.
I beg to differ. I don't get the impression that he is transcending the mind and matter. Because if he did, then he will invoke a higher spirit. He does not. He seems to be within the bounds of the senses.
I agree. He's so
therefore, he definitely, among the secularists, poses what you call a compassionate perspective. But if I want rules, I want absolute rules and not relative rules. What he's recommending would fall within the definition of former Pope Benedict. It will be a tyranny of relativism.
Yes.
Because the goalposts are not defined. And Aurobindo describes Dharma very explicitly. He talks about it being at the social level, then the political level, and human level, and then religious and spiritual. Now, if you exclude the last two, which I don't even bother about spiritual, Dharma has nothing to do with religion, it has to do with spiritual. If you exclude spirituality, you will have a tattered Dharma, which is really of no use in times of crisis. It is a truncated, moth-eaten piece of Dharma, to borrow some words from late Mr. Jinnah, who founded Pakistan. It is to be have its absolute majesty. And if you don't do that, we have working rules. And working rules work sometimes. They are twisted and they become flexible.
I agree totally, but I mean he's approaching the point where he's painting himself in a corner.
That I agree.
And I think at one point he uses two words, and I think he uses them incorrectly. He somehow equates morality with legitimacy. He says that...
With?
Legitimacy. And he says, at the time of the epic, a husband's authority over his wife was complete. Indeed, his honor depended upon his legitimately owning his woman. To expect Bhishma or anyone else in the assembly to answer differently would have required the person to step outside his moral paradigm. And legitimacy is what he's been talking about. He's saying, is it approved by our customs? Is it approved by our traditions? Is it in agreement with the existing laws or rules? In other words, he's put it in a time and place context. He is not able yet, hopefully after he goes on in his life, will do so. He's not able to make this transcendence which I'm referring to, but I think he's approaching it. I say, for a person who started out with such a strongly secular starting point, his reflections almost compel him to go beyond where he has stopped.
You have raised an important point. With regard to legitimacy, my view is as follows. If you look at the history of human society in the Vedic period, there was no such thing as the husband owning the wife. In fact, the name for the wife was Sahadharmini. This means my partner in the sustenance of dharma. A man married a woman so that they can be association, it's an association for sustaining dharma. What is the need for a man and a woman to come together? Basically, he becomes a family man.
Yes.
And sustenance of dharma at the practical level meant that the wandering monks, sannyasis, who went around, giving booster injections to societies with their preaching and all that, they lived on what others fed. So when they come to a village, they'll stay for 10 days. And every family will come and go, please will you honor us by being our guest today. So she will cook for him and this man will wash his feet, bring him and so on. That is why we say guest is God, Atithi Devo Bhava. So she played a role. And in fact, in the famous story of Raja Harishchandra, where sage Vishwamitra tests him about his adherence to truth, at one point the king gives away his property, but he is somewhere else. Sage says, I won't accept it. Your wife is a partner. She must agree to this. And all I'm trying to say is, the women's rights were quite high. Later on, due to atrophy, this kind of domination came. And therefore, the comments he's making refer to a particular period of time.
Yes.
It is a time-related aberration. It is not the actual meaning of the word. There was no law which said the wife is a slave. By custom, yes. But that has also changed.
But I think
That is why I say you need norms that do not depend on changes. Just to give you a very simple example, it has happened, I am sure, elsewhere, but I am quite concerned it is happening here. In the movies, we had a censor board right from the beginning. And then they will see the film and they will say, cut out all these scenes. Of course, there are political reasons. That was understandable. And there are also what you call things that were supposed to be vulgar, quote-unquote. The definition of vulgar was what people believed at that time. The censor board considered inappropriate. So they will show the license and they will put a triangle there. That means it has been cut. The objectionable scenes have been removed. But due to pressure from the media, the licensing has become more and more flexible. And to the point where one of our movie actors said, these days, I cannot take my family and go and see a movie in which I have acted. Not now. This was 15 years or 20 years ago. God knows what the situation is today. So it has come to that kind of elastic and plastic limit. No, we can't have moral laws of that nature. That's exactly what Pope Benedict was saying. Wrong is wrong at all times and at all places, as long as it meets the following definition. But if you say the goalpost can be changed, then we cannot ask for law. So that has been my basic complaint about Mr. Das. You want dharma, but you want flexibility in dharma. Then you will have your own dharma. It's a customized automobile. Okay? But that is not dharma. You cannot describe it as dharma for whole society. You are silent, Bishop. What about you? Because if you are watching, I'll charge you a ticket.
No, I really wanted to hear Professor Peter Prusin's comments because he's come.
No, I'm asking you to come because you are the young vote. You can say both of you are wrong.
No, actually, talking about this issue, of him being secular, and in a slowly, as you said, you know, he's painting himself to a corner. And but the sense that I got is, even though it is very obvious at times, but he's not conceding to that. He's not conceding, you know, even this in this instance where it is so clear that there is a higher power which governed this whole episode of Draupadi's humiliation and her rescue.
Yes.
He wants to, you know, he wants to take up only those things from history and those works of Mahabharata where, you know, they have tried to exclude God, and he wants to say that it is cosmic justice. He doesn't want to explain what is cosmic justice. No. You know, he wants to just leave it at that. Mm-hmm. And he wants to say...
So what do you say in physics, a hand waving it?
Yeah. He wants to leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though it is so obvious that there is something higher which is governing the whole thing. So that to me is a little puzzling. And that doesn't, as sir was saying, then what happens is then all the time we are missing the main frame of reference.
I will not say it is puzzling. You are able to talk like you are able to because you have been groomed in an environment. When you are groomed in that society where the transcendental power is excluded, because you know it's not the right thing to do, it's not fashionable and so on, you grow up in a different kind of sanitary environment. And to you, this looks foul and obnoxious to even talk about such things. So it's a mindset.
Yes.
It's a mindset. There is what you call, in spite of all the apparent objectivity, there is a lot of subjectivity there. Wouldn't you say so?
Absolutely. And when I look at my own experience, when I came to Swami for the first time in 1959, I was 53 years of age. I had no spiritual inclination whatsoever that I knew of within me. I was brought up in an atheist family on very trying times. And when I returned over the years and started to speak about Swami and his teachings, people in the environment that I lived in looked at me as a very, very strange person. And so I'm sure that that Mr. Das also has been extremely affected by the...
So he describes it in his book in the earlier chapters and the last chapter.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Now, allow me to ask you a question.
Thank you.
This is in relation to something that has been grabbing the headlines in the last few days. It is a bit of a sensitive topic, but I do want to refer to the undercurrent of these events. There was a rather notorious paper in a magazine in France, which made it a habit to insult. It lived by giving offenses, offending anybody and everybody it could and get away with it. And they decided, for their reasons of their own, to draw unbecoming cartoons of Prophet Muhammad, knowing full well it will offend.
Yes.
And then there have been consequences, and everybody is condemning the consequences. But more and more, people are claiming the right not to speech, but to be offensive.
Absolutely.
Claiming that it is satire.
Mm.
And now, interestingly, in America, there was a lot of self-censorship. The New York Times refused to publish the cartoons, saying we don't want to offend the sensibility of all, one and all. And so did some others. But others said, to hell with it, we have the right to be offensive, and so they are. So now, what happens to society if, instead of thou shalt not hurt, say, I'm going to hurt, I'm bloody well going to hurt, and I don't care a damn if it hurts. What do you say to that? Is it moral? Is it ethical? Or is it that you have unlimited freedom? This is a fundamental question.
The question is wonderful because actually, this whole event started in Denmark.
I didn't want to. I was aware of that.
There was a series of cartoons, drawings made of the Prophet, which aroused great wrath in many parts of the world. And what we have seen in France now, in Paris, is a follow-up on that. The reactions offend me deeply. The reactions are mainly by the far right. And they are simply saying that we should continue to do this. We have the right to free speech. And in my own country, some of the major newspapers have reprinted those cartoons. Interestingly enough, the magazine, the newspaper that first printed them refused to do it this time. The head of the newspaper said, we have to be sensitive to the situation. We are affecting negatively many, many people, and we're also bringing the lives of our own employees in danger. When he made that comment, he was severely attacked by politicians and by other newspapers. I agree totally that this is a very, very disturbing movement. We are bending over backwards to maintain the right to harm, to injure, to offend other people who have deep persuasions. I think it is terrible, but it is a sign, I think, of the, to use a word you used earlier, sir, the mindset which is prevailing.
That is why Swami always talked about something that will prevent such things from happening. He says, change your wavelength, change your mindset.
Yes.
Treat the other as a part of yourself. You will never hate yourself. The hand will never cannot hit the leg. The stomach cannot hit the head. It's impossible. So, all of you are parts of one. He kept on hammering that, which is why he did not give much importance to religion. So these are important at a practical level. Ownership is important at a practical level, but don't overplay it. He did not give it too much importance to language. I mean, in Belgium you have the fight between Flemish and the French. It's our language. We have it in Canada, French and English. I mean, people can find any damn excuse to quarrel against each other. In Northern Ireland, it's the Catholics versus Protestants, or Sunnis versus Shias. The smallest thing, they will make a big difference out of it and make a fuss about it. Is it worth it? I'll give you one incredible case which will make you roar with laughter. Please roar with laughter later on. This is about an elephant that belonged to a temple in Madras. The temple was built in to revere Parthasarathi. That is a name given to Krishna. Basically, it was a Krishna temple. It was a Vaishnavic temple. Now, we have two brands of Vaishnavics in South India. The northern brand and the southern brand. It's like northerners and southerners in the United States. They both wear a caste mark representative of Vishnu. But the way they wear it is different. In one, the base is flat, the other it is curved. Now the question arose as to how this elephant should be decorated. Should it be decorated in the northern style or southern style? There were protagonists for both. They argued, they fought, they went to court. And finally, we didn't have a Supreme Court at that time. It went to the Privy Council in the British House of Lords. And there were all these Brits, my lords, sitting there. They don't know. They know about an elephant. They didn't know about this caste mark. They had to decide how the elephant's face had to be decorated. Isn't that ridiculous? You're hair splitting over a silly thing like this. And we do become very crazy in these matters. And that is what Swami always resisted. Why do you come to the lowest possible level?
Yes.
Why don't you elevate yourself? If you talk of something elevating, it is considered meaningless. But there is one good thing that is happening. And I want to, since we are coming to the close, I want you all to pick up that refrain. All of a sudden, in the history of the Catholic Church, we find a man like Saint Francis, and he has become so inspiring, atheists like him, which is something very strange and unusual.
Francis of Assisi.
No, the current Pope Francis.
Who has taken his name from...
Yeah, he has taken adopted that name because he's a Jesuit.
Yes.
And for Jesuit, Assisi is the sort of pinnacle.
Yes.
Take it over, Professor.
Oh, I agree totally. I think it is wonderful that we have gotten such a new pope. Looking back in recent history, the popes have not always been a defender in any way of the wholeness that you are speaking of. And as I referred earlier to my own upbringing, I grew up in the Second World War, during the Second World War and before that period, and the Pope at that time had been supporting indirectly the fascist, the Nazis. So that we have a Pope who was the daring to be a loving, kind person spreading the message of love is an amazing, wonderful thing that has happened.
He even can wash the feet of prisoners.
Yes.
All that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, Vishu, it's time to wind up. So you have the last word.
Well, I think the musing that you gave based on this chapter, Draupadi's Courage, was a large part of that was dedicated to this cosmic justice. And you know, you quoted Gandhiji, and you explained very powerfully how what is so obvious is sometimes not seen. And today we touched upon it. I don't know, but that to me is a very interesting topic to
discuss.
Can you
just remind listeners what you mean by that? What is so obvious is?
What is so obvious is when you see that in nature today, in society today, in nature today, there are things which are known and there are things which are unknown. You can categorize things. Science would like to see it that way. There is an apple. And you want to know, okay, how many seeds are there? That is unknown. So you can cut the apple. You say, I can know it. But we forget that there are things which are unknowable. We will never know. We will never know how many apples are going to come out of one seed. So, and there are many things like that today in nature which are absolutely unknowable and which you can only attribute it to some higher force. And I feel this is so obvious, but we don't want to accept this. Even great intellectuals do not want to see that there are things which are unknowable and for which there is a guiding power. And here Das sort of mentions cosmic justice, but you know, he shies away from dwelling on that. And that you have dealt very to some detail in the musing. And I thought that is a very interesting thing to discuss.
Yeah, maybe at some point we should ask, how did we suddenly get to the feeling the unknowables are knowables and therefore they need not be treated as paranormal.
Yes.
Even though we will never be able to explain
yes.
a false sense of what you call enlightenment. I know everything. If I don't know it today, tomorrow I will know it. That has gripped us.
Yes.
So in other words, some kind of delusion has grown.
Yes.
Emerge like a parasite out of this explosion of worldly knowledge.
Could I come with a brief comment on that?
Please do. In which case you will have the last word.
Yes.
what you're saying really touches upon the arrogance of much of science to say that we, given time...
Are you saying scientists are arrogant?
No, many are. Yes, indeed. As many economists are.
You should have said the present company exploded.
Absolutely. A basic starting point is that everything is matter. And since we will be able to learn more and more about matter, we will eventually be able to know everything. And this deals with the whole concept of consciousness, which you touched upon in your comments on chapter 2. A basic starting point for 99.99% of neuroscientists is that consciousness is a result of matter. It's a result of the brain. And therefore, when people die, there is nothing left. In other words, this is a great challenge to all concepts of karma,
yes.
of reincarnation,
yes.
of paramatma.
Yes.
And so at this point, there is a great gap between the mindset or the basic starting point, the fundamental starting point of much of modern science and that of spirituality.
I think this is a very interesting topic and perhaps sometime we should have a discussion on this if sir is willing.
I was just hoping you would say that. And thank you for saying it.
Yeah. So we'll, because time is running out, we'll conclude even though there are so many things I want to share, but I think we have to keep that to another session. So thank you very much, Professor Peter Prusen, for being a part of this discussion. And of course, sir, as always, for his insights and reflections. But for you, we would not be discussing actually these things. So we will be grateful to Bhagwan for his arranged this beautiful discussion on Dharma. Over now to you, Sunil.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end the 9th question and answer session based on Professor Jeevankatraman's earlier talks in this new series based on Dharma. We hope you liked the session, and next week we'll be continuing with the present series. Please don't forget to tune in then, and we shall alert you in advance with web and radio announcements about what's coming up next week. So watch out this space. We thank you for listening, and as always, the podcast of this program may be accessed via our website www.radiosci.org. And dear listeners, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosci.org. And coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment Service, Love in Action. Thank you, and Jai Sai Ram.